Third of all, although the essential focus of the course are the internal complications, internal disputes within these polities, there's always an international connection here. There are always international implications of internal politics. There are always international complications of internal politics. And indeed, what we're going to find out in several cases is that in the end, the tail ends up wagging the dog. That is to say, that a dispute which may begin as an internal disagreement between a monarch and the monarch's subjects ends up being hijacked by powerful neighbors, external forces, for their own ends, so that conflicts which may begin about one set of issues end up being resolved or end up turning on a completely different set of issues. The final aspect of the early modern state we're going to look at is technology. Technologies of resistance, technologies of repression. Now, when I talk about technology, I suppose what instantly comes to mind are tools, things like guns, large artillery, long pointy sticks, things like that. But I think we need to take a much broader conception of technology here and think about things like institutions like courts as technologies. Think about taxation systems as technologies, fiscal technologies, information technologies, political technologies. All of these things are technologies. And in the early modern period, they undergo decisive change. Just to give you perhaps a trivial point, between 1500 and 1700, the average size of an average army on a European battlefield goes up enormously in size for a whole host of reasons, most of which we're going to talk about. Ultimately, the goal of this course is to understand the fundamental nature of the early modern state. What makes it tick? And finally, what is its relationship to the society that it governed? If there is, after all, some kind of a dispute about what is and what is not acceptable in terms of a political organization, we have to look at not just the state in isolation, not just the monarch and the court in isolation, but also the people who are ruled, the peasants, the townspeople, and everyone else. I'd like to begin this lecture today with political theory, because the 16th century is a golden age of political theory. Indeed, I think one could argue that most of the contemporary Western discourse, the vocabulary, the concepts that we use when we talk about politics, received their decisive formation in the 16th and the 17th centuries. The whole notion of rights, the idea that one has a right to do this and a right to do that, the idea of responsibility, political responsibility, become crucially articulated in this period. I think maybe a helpful way to summarize it would be to suggest that the 16th century sees the emergence or the full elaboration of two rival political ideologies. One of these we might want to call constitutionalism, that is to say, the argument that all political authority inheres in the body of the people, although I should add right away that the people in the early modern period rarely means all adults. It certainly doesn't include women, and it certainly doesn't include actually most people. I think I'm going to use a concept very often here of the political nation, by which I mean the people who count. But when people theorize about constitutionalism in the 16th century, they are at least talking about some kind of relationship between the monarchy and the political nation, and this idea that political authority inheres in the body of the people, and therefore that all rulers are subject to criticism and indeed, potentially, to deposition by their own subjects. Constitutionalism we will deal with in greater detail in the second lecture, but the other rival theory is the one we're going to talk about most in this present lecture, and that is absolutism. That is to say, the argument that the king, or the monarch, is accountable to no one else but himself, and, crucially, that the subject owes complete, unquestioning obedience to the monarch. Now, it must be stressed that neither of these views is completely new in the 16th century. Each of them, absolutism and constitutionalism, have clear medieval antecedents. What is new in the 16th and 17th centuries is the rigor with which these two ideologies or types of ideologies are elaborated, are discussed, are debated, often across the division, the religious division, between Protestants and Catholics. The religious unity of the Middle Ages, when almost everybody was a Catholic Christian, was fractured by the emergence of Protestantism in the early 16th century. This course will not offer a comprehensive religious history of the Reformation, but since we are deeply concerned with the political implications of religious division, conflicts between and within the various Christian denominations will pervade our discussion. Having said that about religion, I should, however, stress that there is never any neat correspondence between religious denomination and political ideology. Indeed, advocates of both views, advocates of both absolutism and constitutionalism, can be found in virtually all Christian denominations in this period. Indeed, elements of both absolutist thought and constitutional thought can sometimes be found in the writings of the same person. A classic example is the Spanish Jesuit priest Francisco Suarez, who lived between 1548 and 1617, who wrote an enormous corpus which you could trawl for both absolutist and constitutional arguments. If there isn't any neat correspondence between religion and political ideology, that brings us to a third observation about these theories, and that is that the reception of political theory, by which I mean how it actually plays out in practice, is a really complicated problem. The relationship between ideas and events is always tricky. In the first place, no polity, no political community was ever converted in some sense to absolutism on the strength of a treatise. People don't read a constitutional treatise and say, oh, good gracious, let's get rid of the king. It doesn't work that way. At the same time, however, I think it would be quite misleading to assume that all political and religious ideologies, all of these treatises and tracts which come pouring off the presses in this period, are merely some kind of a cover to legitimate crass material ambitions. It is true. It should be stressed. It is quite true that high-minded ideals were often invoked in the early modern period to justify a really distressingly broad range of actions, and that remains as true today as it was in the 17th century. Nevertheless, we should keep in mind that it was never possible to invoke the Bible or Protestant liberties or the Catholic tradition or these sorts of things to justify every course of action. There are certain kinds of things which couldn't be justified by calling on the traditional normative language of early modern European society. And as we shall see, therefore, the ideologies which were available to Europeans in this period would impose very real constraints on what practical politics could actually be.